You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter Being Global. Not long ago, for most companies, being international meant conducting an import-export business. If an American corporation had some outposts overseas, they were designed to facilitate the movement of goods to and from the United States. Except among mining and oil companies, little or no production occurred abroad. The next stage in the evolution of global firms came when companies set up overseas branches and subsidiaries to serve specific geographical markets. For example, the Ford Motor Company simply owned a company within, say, England, and Ford would produce cars there for British citizens. But its British operations were usually tightly directed by and heavily dependent on the Detroit Home Office. The same national focus and reporting lines to the United States applied to Ford's subsidiaries in France and Japan. Then, in the 1980s, came the multinational company in which production of foreign subsidiaries was integrated and the end products themselves became internationalized. Toyota could produce transmissions in Japan, axles in Malaysia, car frames in Indonesia, and assemble the complete auto in Thailand, from which it proceeded to export. This type of integrated production is becoming the norm, not only in manufacturing, but also in finance, law, and consulting businesses, where specialists from all over the world deliver an integrated service. Thus, Goldman Sachs can provide advice to China's telecom industries by bringing together its specialists from New York, London, Tokyo, and Hong Kong with expertise on communications technology as well as listing requirements and underwriting techniques in the US, Europe, and Asian markets. The latest evolution of international business has been the growing number of mergers of companies of different nationalities. Some of these have been in the same industry, such as melding of British Petroleum and Amoco, Daimler-Benz and Chrysler, Deutsche Bank and Bankers Trust, Bertelsmann and Random House, WPP and Young and Rubicam. Others have brought together disparate businesses that the information age is linking together, such as Vivendi and its communications capabilities, Seagram's, which owned Universal Studios, etc. In these cases, it's not just production that's being internationalized, but a corporation's culture and its people. The pace of change will only accelerate. In Europe and Japan, rigid economic models are being jettisoned in favor of less overbearing government regulation, more attention to shareholders and labor policies that allow wages to rise and fall within the market and workers to more easily move from job to job. This restructuring of economics has only just begun. Big emerging markets like India, Indonesia, and Brazil are still in the early stages of their full participation in the world economy. And their impact on global finance and trade has only begun to be felt. China, in particular, is a work in progress. For all the publicity about its turn towards market-oriented policies, for all the attention given to the pragmatism of some of its top government officials, no one knows what the future will hold for international developments in this nation of over a billion people just beginning to experience economic freedom. McKinsey and Company predicts a phenomenal expansion of worldwide trade. While 20% of the goods and services produced now enters international trade, McKinsey says the proportion could increase to 80% within 30 years. In this environment, we can count on increased competition as trade and regulatory barriers keep dropping and a new spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship catches on in both advanced and in emerging markets. New firms will be popping up everywhere, adding to the supply of products and services, increasing customer choice, and driving down prices. A wave of large mergers and a growing number of strategic alliances among corporations of different nationalities will create new classes of rivals. CEOs will surely be exposed to new and higher levels of risk arising from a highly competitive environment where so many changes are occurring at once. But at a pace that varies from country to country, from region to region, changes in the number and nature of players, in the mindset of those who set the rules, and in the rules themselves. It is also certain that in the new business-to-business markets will open up new opportunities for new suppliers that were never on the previous radar screen. They will come from China, Indonesia, India, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, Turkey, to be sure. But also they will come from entrepreneurs in developed countries. The internet will allow companies to scan for opportunities around the world as they never could before. A steel plant in South Korea that has excess capacity will be able to find the customer in Argentina who needs an immediate special delivery. An agricultural business in Poland needing an added supply of tractors on short notice can spot an opportunity to buy surplus equipment from Komatsu in Japan. All this internet-aided business will put enormous pressure on global supply and demand management by big companies and compel a level of flexibility and adaptability that will test the talents of all CEOs. As the system of production and consumption becomes more rationalized, the substantial overcapacity that exists in the production facilities of industries like autos, petrochemicals, and semiconductors will have to be eliminated. Many companies and countries and millions of workers will experience the impact of these future dislocations. One factor in the rethinking of global strategy is a growing need to tap into regions of the world where considerable pools of expertise exist and have so far been unexploited. This is a preoccupation of leaders like Frederick Smith of FedEx. Smith conceived of the business of express mail while a student at Yale in the mid-1960s. After a stint in the Marines and two combat tours in Vietnam, he started the company and in the process revolutionized not just how mail is sent, but how inventories around the world are managed. He has taken a more direct charge of his international operations than most CEOs. I first met him in 1995 on a trade mission to China, led by the late Ron Brown, then Secretary of Commerce. Smith impressed me as being exceptionally knowledgeable about China. I recall his drawing Brown aside before a meeting with a Chinese minister and suggesting, in his slight southern drawl, what was likely to be on the minister's mind. In those 5 minutes, Smith imparted more insight for the meeting than our entire briefing book, which had been prepared over many weeks with the help of the U.S. Embassy and intelligence services. Now, 4 years later, in our interview in a New York hotel, Smith was talking about contracts he had signed with aircraft manufacturers in the Czech Republic. He is among the first major Western aircraft users to do so, and he feels he's found a new reservoir of expertise. Quote, "There's a huge factory over there, and nobody else would give those guys an order," unquote, he said. "But I was very comfortable with the fact that they could make wonderful airplanes. They did a hell of a good job for the Germans during the World War II, just for starters." American Express Kenneth Chinot is also preoccupied with finding people who are yet undiscovered and underutilized. Quote, "There are no longer any boundaries to where talent is and where and how it can be deployed," he said. "The battle at home and around the world is going to be for ideas and non-traditional thinking, and we have to look at the entire global market as the playing field," unquote. The search raises the issue of how best to manage people from vastly different cultures within one multicultural organization. Jack Welsh told me, quote, "You have to lead a global organization by engaging everybody. You have to globalize your intellectual capital. You have to get every mind into the game," unquote. But are CEOs willing to find minds that are truly different from what they are accustomed to, or simply foreign minds that think more or less like people in their own company? The question is posed by Susan Beresford, who has spent nearly her entire professional career at the Ford Foundation. We met her in her office not far from the United Nations. On the bookcases was a set of exotic wooden artifacts from Africa. Draped over some of the chairs were colorful textiles from Indonesia and India. Amid all this sat a modern glass conference table. Beresford put it this way, quote, "Are we looking for people like us, but with different nationality, sort of like us? Or are we looking for people who are considerably different by virtue of history, culture, and experience and language? How far are we really willing to go?" For most companies, however, they would say publicly the real answer is not very far. American multinationals are on the lookout for, say, Chinese students who speak excellent English and hold an MBA from a recognized U.S. university. But this isn't diving into a diverse global genre pool. How many companies are looking for future executives from the Fudan University in Shanghai? In how many ways you can't blame them for the process of finding, evaluating, and integrating people who are truly different is enormously difficult and is also time-consuming. Just achieving ethnic and racial diversity within national firms where people come from similar backgrounds is a long way off in virtually every country, as recent racial diversity problems in prominent U.S. firms like Texaco and Coca-Cola indicate. When BP acquired Amoco, it reached out to experts, including some in universities like Yale, to better understand the history, culture, and legal dimensions of workforce diversity as it evolved in the United States. Clearly, Britain and the United States are more aware and concerned of achieving diversity than most other countries. Companies in continental Europe and certainly Japan are far less progressive. As important as creating a multicultural management team is, no one should underestimate the difficulty. I had a taste of the complications in mid-1980s when I was in charge of Lehman Brothers investment banking activities in Asia, and I was living in Tokyo. For 18 months, I oversaw the restructuring of a gigantic near-bankrupt shipping company headquartered in Hong Kong. Our restructuring team was composed of Americans, Japanese, and Hong Kong Chinese. It was easy enough for us to discuss strategy. However, in the heat of the crisis, when we were moving fast to negotiate with individual creditors of many different nationalities, many misunderstandings and increasing tensions arose within our own team. For example, Japan had no tradition of debt restructuring as we in the United States knew it. Generally, if bankers wanted to save a bankrupt company, they just lent it more money. So our Japanese team members had a very difficult time grasping that you can write down the size of the debt or transform one kind of debt into another and demand certain performance changes from the indebted company in return. In Hong Kong, on the other hand, there was no such thing as a Chapter 11, a provision in U.S. bankruptcy law that allows a debtor some breathing room by protecting assets from being seized while devising a reorganization plan. Instead, as soon as a Hong Kong company couldn't pay its debts, it was liquidated and all of its properties were auctioned off. In this case, however, we had agreement from all the creditors to adhere to the de facto Chapter 11 arrangement. But our Chinese colleagues did not fully understand that the hangman wasn't just outside the door, and they were itching to make small side deals with creditors to keep them from forcing a liquidation. Transparency was also a problem. Americans on the team felt compelled to make sure everything was happening and was as public as possible. Our experience told us the worst thing that could happen in a big corporate restructuring was that some lender felt another was getting favored treatment. The only way to instill confidence that every aspect of the restructuring deal was fair was to let everyone know exactly what was happening and what was being offered to every creditor. Accordingly, we felt that open communication was essential, not just with creditors, but also with the press. But Japan and Hong Kong had a tradition of backroom dealing, with favoritism to the powerful institutions and close friends. The notion of spending time cultivating and educating reporters so that they could present the story in an accurate and timely way was totally alien to the Asian members of our team. The most difficult thing for me was basic communication within the team when we were under pressure. We were moving fast and a lot had to be left unsaid. I had a knot in my stomach virtually all the time because I was sure that some of my Asian colleagues were hearing the words but actually were not understanding them. This wasn't anyone's fault. The American, Japanese, and Chinese experiences were just very different. I confess that I wished many times that the team was composed only of Americans like me.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF, 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garten. We are still looking at the chapter, Being Global. Another task for CEOs will be to incorporate an increasing number of highly educated and skilled people into their organizations. Unlike low-cost laborers, these expectations center mainly on basic needs. These so-called knowledge workers will be more difficult to accommodate. Their aspirations for advancement will be greater. The best of them are likely to be heavily courted and wooed not just with high remuneration, but with visas and geographical organizational mobility. Finding them and keeping them will require multinationals to build new sets of relationships with those foreign institutions where skilled workers have links, such as universities and research centers. Given the rapid advancement of knowledge today, multinational companies will have to learn to spot and cultivate talent at earlier stages of development, much as athletic scouts look for future stars among the very young. For global corporations, most of whom are still struggling to internationalize their top management staffs, this kind of recruiting breaks substantially new ground. The ability to use a diverse workforce to upgrade the knowledge base of the company will be an invaluable asset to CEOs. Consider the importance of sharing information across borders. You have so many different cultures in the world. It's incredible that from the standpoint of idea generation, Daimler, Chrysler's Jürgen Schriftmop told me in our interview in Stuttgart. In the same way, John Brown changed the structure of the petroleum industry with his European-American mega merger, and Schrempf shook up the auto industry by linking Daimler Benz with Chrysler. After that colossal transaction, people began to invoke the age of Daimler Chrysler as a synonym for a new era of globalization. Schrempf was as intense as any CEO I have ever met, a serious mountain climber in his free time. On more than one occasion in our session, he punctuated his thoughts with a flourish of his clenched fist as if he was going to pound the table. He exuded passion throughout the interview on his strategies, on threats to do business from too much regulation, on his personal interest in economic development in South Africa, at one point leaning forward with such energy that he seemed to come unconnected from his chair. Quote, "At Daimler Chrysler, we are able to tap into our great talent in the area of research and development, but we must now do the same thing with our entire value stream of the company, whether it's accounting or purchasing or anything else," he said. "The challenge, quite simply, is to share knowledge wherever we possibly can. But there are cultural barriers to sharing. Breaking down walls is difficult. The traditional thing was I'll always have something in my drawer which is private for me, my knowledge, because I want to be superior. The internet makes it easier to break down the barriers, of course, but we will still have a way to go to maximize what would be possible and what is essential. If Daimler Chrysler is struggling, you can be sure that other large multinationals are struggling as well. After all, it is a global corporation composed of employees of two companies that had long done business in one another's home territories, sprang from two advanced societies that had shared culture for many generations. The world is much bigger and more diverse than the United States and Western Europe, And the global company of tomorrow will need to put deep roots in less familiar ground in places like Asia, Latin America, and ultimately Islamic countries. The course of Daimler Chrysler tells a good deal of the globalization story. The need for geographical reach and the problems of achieving it. The importance of cross-cultural diversity and the difficulty of making it work. The promise of leveraging assets around the world and the obstacles to making it happen. A year and a half after the company went public, the shares were trading at barely half their original value, with financial troubles plaguing Chrysler in particular. Despite Shrimp's efforts to create a multinational culture, several of Chrysler's most highly regarded top executives simply left. While some of the synergies from the combination of the two companies were evident, the integration of business, which was supposed to lead growth, took a back seat to more cost-cutting and more layoffs. An overwhelming proportion of management time went into post-merger integration, with significant costs for the operations itself. While it's still too early to say how the merger will fare over time, the transaction shows from a CEO standpoint that running a major global company is fraught with hazards. Despite all the travels, Shrimp isn't finished. In mid-2000, Daimler Chrysler took control of Mitsubishi Motors in Japan. This transaction will add new complications to the management of cross-cultural differences, to say the least. In addition, the heavily indebted Japanese automaker requires a financial turnaround. Say this for Shrimp. He is determined to make Daimler Chrysler a truly global firm, no matter what the hurdles he encounters. In our interview, which preceded so many of his late 2000 headaches, he described his vision of serving all major markets by having production capabilities in each, quote, 30% in North America, 30% in Europe, and 30% in Asia, he said. He seems to be undeterred from getting there. We're going to continue looking at this book in future shows and unwrapping the role of CEOs in inventing the futures for their respective companies.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.